You ready to proceed?
Morning, Justice. May it please the court, my name is Matt Warnkowski. I represent the claimant below, the appellant in this matter, Joanne Cullen. This matter arises out of a work-related injury that my client had while working for the state of Delaware on September 25th, 1995. The mechanism of the accident that my client had slipped and fell, falling into her left wrist, she injured her left wrist, her ankle. She ultimately had a number of surgeries on the left wrist, also on the left elbow, approximately 10 surgeries, which basically prevented her from using her left arm. Her left arm is in a splint. She's also developed a right carpal tunnel syndrome on the right side because she has to constantly use the right hand. She's on medication, four different types of medication, Oxycontin, Oxycodone, those are narcotic pain medications, as well as Topamax and Roxycodone, which are also different types of pain medications. Ms. Cullen's testified that the pain in her elbow is constant. It's a burning pain. It's a ripping pain.
Let me ask you, assume we're familiar with her problems. Tell us what the Superior Court did wrong by affirming the industrial accident.
Sure. The court erred in affirming the decision for a couple of reasons. One is the Superior Court confirmed what the Industrial Accident Board said, that there was no change in my client's condition between the termination petition that was consented to back in 2001 and the petition that we filed for temporary total disability benefits in 2002. What had happened at that period of time in 2000, let me step back, Mike. My client was receiving temporary total disability benefits from 1995 through 2000 when the state sent her to a Dr. Traeger for a defense medical exam. Dr. Traeger at that time had indicated that my client could use her left arm but had restrictions on it, and there were no restrictions on her right arm. My client consented to the termination petition, and her testimony before the board was that she believed that this would just transfer to her Social Security benefits and that would take over, as she had been recently approved for Social Security benefits, and she didn't realize that she could get both of those benefits. Later, when she found out that she could, she went back to her doctor, who was Dr. Culp. Dr. Culp said, you can't do any type of work. And that's what prompted the petition that we've had.
Well, for me, who never practiced workers' comp, tell me what the significance is of her agreeing to terminate benefits.
Correct. There was never a hearing on the petition to terminate. The employer filed a petition to stop her temporary total disability benefits, meaning her weekly checks that she was receiving for being out of work. The employer filed that petition based upon that Dr. Traeger saying that she can go back to work doing something. Ms. Cullen did not contest that petition, and what happened was is when she didn't contest the petition, her checks had stopped at that point.
Suppose she did contest the petition, then what?
If she contested the petition and she was successful in defeating that, her temporary total disability benefits would have continued. If the state was successful, then the benefits would have stopped.
What is the legal significance of her concluding that, for whatever reason, that she would not contest it?
Well, and I think maybe that's part of what our argument here today is.
Well, that's why I'm asking the question.
And it's our contention is that there was no official adjudication of this. There was no hearing where the court said, we believe you can go back to work. Ms. Cullen agreed to the termination petition just as she has testified because she felt that her Social Security benefits would take this up. The effect of it was that her checks had stopped.
But that's all factual. The question the Chief Justice asks is, so what, legally?
Well, I think that comes into when we refile the petition for the recurrence of total disability benefits. That we filed for beginning in October of 2002, that she was then able to, our petition was that she was unable to work as of that date. I think the effect of what that is, and what the court had said and what the board below said was, well, you agreed to your benefits being cut off by that termination petition, and you haven't shown that there was any kind of change in your physical condition, therefore we're denying your petition for your recurrence of total disability benefits.
Now, is it your position that the record doesn't support that conclusion?
Correct.
How does it not? Because obviously the other side's position is it does, at least there's evidence in the record to support it, and we shouldn't substitute our judgment on that record for either the IAB or the Superior Court. Well, so tell us why that's wrong.
The reason it's wrong is because, like I said, they sent Ms. Cullen to Dr. Traeger back in 2000, which was the basis of the employer filing that termination petition. They first had to have a doctor that would give an opinion that Ms. Cullen could go back to work. And with Dr. Traeger saying that she could go back to work, but with restricted use of her left arm, that no restrictions on her right arm. In May of 2002, the employer sent her to Dr. Racis for another defense medical exam, the same type of exam. Now in 2002, Dr. Racis says she essentially can't use her left arm.
Counsel, you know, Dave, what's floating around in your brief and in your argument is this notion that your client agreed to a termination of benefits based on some misapprehension of the facts or the law. Our question is, do you make any legal argument whatsoever based on that?
Well,
yes or no?
I guess yes, I do, but I think it in terms of that change in condition, in terms of the factual, we agree that she consented to her to terminate her temporary total disability benefits back in 2000 that resulted in the checks being stopped in 2001.
Well, it appears that you have two arguments, and tell us which one you're making. Either she shouldn't be deemed to have terminated her benefits, and therefore she shouldn't have to show a change in condition, or she accepts the fact that her benefits were terminated and she has demonstrated a changed condition.
That's what our argument is that she has consented to the termination petition. We can't change that.
So all we're going to focus on is whether or not she's demonstrated a change in her physical condition.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And that's why we believe that there has, based upon not our physician.
What, if any, relevance is there to the fact that the board and the Superior Court thought she had commuted her benefits, which would have been accepting a lump sum payout rather than just voluntarily agreeing to terminate them? Is that an important misconception?
Absolutely. I think that is the most important problem in the board's decision.
That's where I was headed, and I appreciate Justice Holland articulating it more distinctly. What is the significance of a commutation of benefits as opposed to a termination of benefits? Your brief suggests that if it's a commutation, it's irrevocable, and she could never come back.
Correct.
And that's what the board and Superior Court thought had happened. But if it's simply an acquiescence and a termination of benefits, then based on a factual change in condition, she can come back and have her benefits reinstated. Is that the distinction?
That is correct. If there was a commutation, if my client had agreed to commute all of her benefits in terms of a lump sum, she would be precluded from even bringing a petition for any additional benefits or those benefits which she commuted.
Well, your opponent simply says that they misstated it. But in fact, the consequence is the same. Is that incorrect?
That is incorrect. This is the Industrial Accident Board that governs all of these workers' compensation cases. They deal with termination petitions. They deal with commutation petitions on a regular basis. And there's a very large significance between the difference between a commutation and a termination petition, just as you've described. If my client consented to a termination petition, that does not preclude her from bringing any claim for any future benefits, including the temporary total disability benefits. If she commuted her benefits for a lump sum, she would be precluded from bringing that type of claim.
And that issue is not mentioned in the Superior Court opinion, right?
No, and the Superior Court didn't even bring that issue up at all, which was troubling to me, in fact, that is a one of the most significant parts.
So your point is that the board shouldn't be affirmed and given that mistaken factual precedent.
Correct. That the board's decision should be reversed, or at the very least, that my client could have her day before the board with the correct facts, and that the board would have the correct understanding of what is going on to have a chance to prove her case. That, along with the other mistaken facts by the board throughout its decision had committed not just a misnomer or an awkward statement, but had misidentified facts that they relied upon in making their decision.
Let's stay with commutation for a moment.
Sure.
The other side argues that that was an unfortunate choice of language, but did not betray a misunderstanding of what really happened, which is that your client voluntarily consented to a termination.
Well, the Industrial Accident Board, this isn't something that you can just make a misnomer about and say, well, gee, a commutation and a termination of your temporary total disability benefits is one and the same. If you are going to try to use them interchangeably, we have something that's very significantly different. And the board, who makes all the decisions on workers' compensation, shouldn't make those type of errors and should know the difference.
I guess what's confusing me is there was, in fact, a hearing before the board, wasn't there, to determine whether or not she had a changing condition? And if they genuinely believed that it was a commutation and that she wasn't even entitled to petition for it, why was there a factual hearing with findings about a change condition?
That's correct. If the board believed that there was a commutation, then there would have been a dismissal from the very beginning when the petition was filed, because there would have been a commutation.
I feel like a dog chasing his tail right now.
And that's the same feeling that I had reading the decision, because the decision says one thing, but then the basis for the decision is something completely different.
Tell me then, just very plainly, why did they have a hearing, the purpose of which was to inquire into whether her condition had changed or not, if indeed they believe that there had been a commutation and she had no right to petition for benefits?
And I don't know. And I think that's the confusing part of the board's reasoning.
Well, doesn't it mean that the board didn't really believe that there had been a commutation, because they had a hearing, and that somehow that word slipped into the opinion and shouldn't have, but it did?
Well, I think it shows that the board was mistaken. Whether they believed that there was a commutation, or they were confused about what happened in the past, we don't know, because you can't tell from their decision of them just inserting that word. I guess my point is, if they were going to insert the word that they believe that that my client had commuted her benefits, that's such a strong statement and such a difference from what had actually occurred.
That is one interpretation. But the other interpretation is that the board simply used the wrong term. Now, if those are two equally reasonable interpretations, and your side has the burden of showing that that constituted reversible legal error, how do you meet that burden?
Well, I think we do, in that there are two reasonable interpretations. However, we have the Industrial Accident Board, who's making this decision, who's in charge of all of the workers' compensation cases. If we have a claimant who goes through this and comes down with a decision and says to the claimant, we're denying your claim based upon that you've commuted your benefits, that in and of itself, of using that word, I don't think that...
Was that their conclusion, or was it their conclusion that the facts didn't support a change in condition?
They had two statements. One was that the claimant did not meet their burden of proof, and then they stated the claimant has commuted her benefits and would not be entitled to these benefits.
So can you give us the highlights of your argument on her proof that her condition changed and where the board went wrong on that.
Sure. And I think you have to look at the position of the employer, or the physicians, I should say, of the employer, Dr. Traeger, in 2000, saying that Ms. Cullen can do some kind of work with her left arm, that she has restrictions in her left arm, and that she has no restrictions in her right. Then you have Dr. Races in 2002 for the employer, again saying she has essentially no use of her left arm, and now she's got a diagnosis of carpal tunnel syndrome. So by their own physician, she's now gotten worse. She's gone from being able to use her left arm in 2000 to not being able to use it at all, and then now having a diagnosis of carpal tunnel syndrome on the right side in 2002, where there was none in 2000. And Dr. Races's opinions continued even to his exam in February of 2003 as well. So just by their own doctors, we see that she has a progression where her restrictions are getting worse, according to those doctors.
Are you saying that there was or there was not contradictory medical testimony as to whether there had been a change in her condition?
There was a contradiction. Okay. In that.
One doctor said there was and the other said there wasn't.
Well, what Dr. Culpin said was...
Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And the board chose to accept the testimony of the doctor that says there wasn't. Is that correct?
Not necessarily, because the board said we accept both doctors. The board says we accept Dr. Culp's testimony regarding her workability. We accept Dr. Races's testimony regarding her work capability. So they basically, essentially said, we agree with both doctors, which is another problem in the board's decision. This isn't a case where they merely said, gee, we chose Dr. Races. We believe him. We don't believe Dr. Culp. End of story.
You wanted to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, and I know you wanted to finish your answer to Justice Jacobs' question, but do you want to go on or reserve?
I'll reserve.
Dennis Manson, I represent the state of Delaware in this matter. And if I may, I'd like to begin, members of the board, with the appellant as the claimant in this matter. The theory of her case was that she came to the board with a petition to determine additional compensation due, alleging a recurrence of total disability. Her specific claim was that she was totally disabled as of 10/5/02 and ongoing, October 5/02 and ongoing. And her sole theory below with the Industrial Accident Board was, I do not have residual capacity to work. I've been injured. I have no functional capacity to work. I'm medically disabled from all employment.
And the board rejected her claim that she was totally disabled.
That is correct.
But she still receives some compensation for partial disability or no compensation,
Honor,
at all?
No, that's correct.
But she is partially disabled, isn't she?
No, Your Honor. She is not partially disabled. The board rejected her a petition for total disability benefits, which does include a partial disability analysis, but her average weekly wage was something in the order of $75 per week, and the employer, the labor market survey and the evidence that demonstrated her employability demonstrated a far greater earning capacity than her date of accident average weekly wage.
You're saying she can make more money now than she did before she was injured?
That is yes, I mean, that's not necessarily part of the board's reasoning in this case. She came before the board with the theory to say, I'm totally disabled. Find me totally disabled based on my doctor's opinion that I'm totally disabled, and that was rejected.
Did the board make a finding that she suffered no loss of earning capacity?
No, not that I'm aware of. I didn't see that in the board's decision.
And in fact, she lost the use of her left arm.
Correct.
That was undisputed, and she has problems with her right arm.
Correct.
The nature of which may be disputed. So there's been a change since the accident.
Your Honor, if I may, I'd like to respond to you by saying that I think we have to be careful about when we talk about change of condition. I know my opponent argues that because of Dr. Traeger, who didn't testify in front of the board, he just had a record of a prior evaluation, that the change of restrictions from Dr. Traeger to Dr. Reyes's indicated a change of condition. A change of condition is really a matter of, from the employer's perspective, a matter of physical condition in terms of what's going on with you clinically, what's going on with you diagnostically, what's going on with you in terms of where you are over the course of time. And Dr. Culp, the treating doctor, clearly said at the very conclusion of my cross-examination to him, I asked him, was there any change in this lady's condition from May of 2000 up until the last time you saw her in October of 2002? And his response was, no, there's not been any real change in her condition. And this is the factual basis upon which the board ultimately decides and concludes that
there's been a,
Dr. Reyes's
when was the accident?
The accident was in 95, Your Honor.
Okay.
But she had gone through a series of surgeries. And from the time of her last surgery up until the time that she is claiming a disability as of October 2 of 2, that's where Dr. Culp's specifically indicated that there's been no change in condition. And Your Honor, if I may also point out that Dr. Reyes also made that conclusion as well. Dr. Reyes saw the claimant, if my memory serves me correctly, in May of 2002 and November of 2003. Dr. Reyes, of course, is an expert in upper extremity problems, and he said that clinically she had not changed from one examination to the other. So the board is hearing evidence from the treating doctor himself, hearing evidence from Dr. Reyes that there's been no change in her condition. Now, we can argue about what restrictions apply. Dr. Culp said, well, I think that, you know, maybe she could lift a little bit with her left arm. She didn't have any restrictions with her right arm. Dr. Reyes would say, no use of the left arm. I think that he would ultimately say she ought to do something in a sedentary capacity. And Dr. Culp also makes that recommendation, is if you're looking just at the right arm itself, work within a restriction of no lifting over 10 pounds, no repetitive usage of the right arm.
Clearly her abilities and her condition were impaired at least after 1995, between 1995 and October of 2002, correct?
Agreed, Your Honor.
And if there was no change between October of 2002 and the date of the IAB hearing, then she would still be permanently partially disabled, would you know?
Yes, Your Honor. If I may, the relevant time frame here is, in terms of the analysis of the Industrial Accident Board, is that in part of their decision making of this case is that we filed a termination petition previously in 01. And during the course of that litigation, Ms. Cullen voluntarily consented to the fact that she no longer was totally disabled. That's what that means. She agrees on the record, agreeing that our termination petition should be granted as of the date of filing.
We now know, with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, and she agreed to do that because she was going to get disability payments, or she was going to get Social Security, or at least that's what's represented in your position, is for whatever reason she decided, once she terminated, she had the burden of showing a change in condition. And if she could have successfully resisted the termination petition, she should have done that. But since she didn't, she's stuck with the burden of proof, and the burden of proof is her condition didn't change.
Well, yes, change of condition is not necessarily a legal standard that she has to come into and prove. I got to prove legally that I've changed my condition. I think that that's a factual issue.
Right.
And, when she consented to the termination petition, she agreed on the record that she was no longer totally disabled.
But in layman's terms, you're saying that's tough luck for her.
Your Honor, I'm not saying it's tough luck for her at all. I'm saying that if she wanted to succeed and she could establish her burden by preponderance of the evidence, that things changed in the sense that, look, I know I consented to the fact that I wasn't disabled in June of 01, but over a year and a half later, things had really changed under the sun here for me. And now I'm totally disabled as of October 5 or October 2 of 02 and ongoing. And the board found that she had not met that burden to make that establishment.
Suppose that the claimant had not voluntarily terminated her payments.
Yes.
At that point, your client filed a petition for a determination that she had no disability, that she was entitled to no compensation.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to follow you. Are you saying hypothetically back in time?
Yes, back in time.
Okay, fine.
Right. Assume counterfactually.
Yes.
That there had been no termination, that she was content to go on the way she had been since 1995. Your client then files a petition to terminate all payments, contending that she's not disabled in any legal way, legally significant way. The claimant, on the other hand, takes the position that she is now totally disabled.
Yes.
The board rejects her contention that she's totally disabled.
Yes.
Would there be any basis in the record for the board to reject her contention that at the very least she remained partially disabled?
If I may, Your Honor, if I may address this, because
I know a number of
questions are coming from you on that issue. That total disability, if I may, Your Honor, remember, has two prongs to it. It has, the first prong is medical capacity to work or incapacity to work. If on a recurrence claim you go over the first hurdle and say, or on a recurrence allegation here for her, she makes the allegation, I can't work at all. I have no residual capacity to work. I have no functional ability to work. I can't do it. I can't perform any task in the labor market. If she succeeds, she wins. Let's say the board on that factual side says, well, Justice Jacobs, you're inquiring about, board finds you can work. We find that you can work, but you have restrictions from that. So that hurdle, she loses on the hurdle of finding me totally disabled because I'm medically incapacitated. Now the second prong is, are you employable within those restrictions? And that's when you get into partial analysis, Your Honor. That's when you get into the issue.
So would you answer my question?
Yes.
She takes an alternative position. Number one, that I'm totally disabled, but even if I'm not, at the very least, I remain partially disabled and am entitled to continue these payments. Was there any basis for the board to say, no, you're not entitled even to that?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes,
what is that basis?
Well, the basis is, first of all, if I may, I'm going to just say that she was sort of like putting all her eggs in one basket. She was saying, please find me medically incapacitated from all work. And when she lost on that theory, she lost her case.
She didn't make an alternative argument.
Correct, Your Honor, if I may. But if she had made the alternative argument and the board would have carried it out further to say, well, you have restrictions. The question is then, are you employable within those restrictions? And then the analysis would be, yes, yes or no, you're employable within those restrictions. And if you get to the point where you're saying you're employable, what's your earning capacity? What could you make when you go out there? And that's where you're into the area of partial disability under 2325. And her average weekly wage, her deed of accident average weekly wage, we call Your Honor, if I may, was $75 per week. That's what she was earning at the time of the injury. That's my record. And all of the jobs in the open labor market demonstrating her capacity to work within the restrictions outlined by Drs. Races and Dr. Culp, if I may, showed a far greater earning capacity than, I forget the number, but I mean, we're in a $250 range.
Even though she had lost the use of her left arm and she had severe problems with her right arm and was on narcotic pain medication, her earning capacity had effectively trebled. Therefore, she would be entitled to no
That's correct,
industrial That's accident related.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And if I may, Your Honor, going back to the heart of this, the real issue of this, if I may, is the idea, the conclusion that Dr. Culp draws that you are medically incapacitated from working. Please recall, if I may, over in his testimony, he said you can't use your left arm. You have basically sedentary restrictions on your right arm. And the third prong is of his conclusion, the premise that underlines his conclusion is because of the medication. But the medication issue is an issue where Dr. Culp was saying caused a decision-making problem, a cognitive deficit, and a drowsiness problem. And if I may, Your Honor, that linchpin, that premise, was taken out by the Industrial Accident Board because they found that there was no cognitive deficit. Because Dr. Culp said that if it wasn't for the alleged medication usage problem, you know, the decision making and the drowsiness problem, she could work. And ergo, you know, there goes the theory. That peg of the conclusion is taken out and the theory collapses. And that's what happened with the Industrial Accident Board.
Just to help with the record, where in the record did the board look to find that she had no cognitive problem caused by narcotics or otherwise?
Multiple areas, Your Honor, if I may. First, Dr. Races, on his exception, the board relied on Dr. Races clearly. Dr. Races said, I examined her twice. She demonstrated absolutely no cognitive orienteering problem with me. She was very articulate. She's a very good historian. Doctors rely upon history. They rely upon communications with patients to determine whether or not there's any kind of cognitive problem. So that's number one. Number two, Dr. Races also expressed the evaluation opinion that this lady had been taking narcotic medication, because that's the real issue, is the opium. She had been taking this narcotic medication for an extended period of time, from 95 really on. And Dr. Races said that you build a tolerance to that. And he detected no problem whatsoever along that line. And most importantly, the 3 inches of medical records that were part of this case that Dr. Races clearly reviewed did not demonstrate Ms. Culling having this difficulty. And this is very, very provocative in the sense that if you're going to have a decision-making problem, if you're going to have a drowsiness problem, it's going to show up in somebody's consult record. But you're going to express that to a doctor. With the exception of the Neurontin is played as a big issue, but the Neurontin was titrated down, it was eliminated, And that was an issue of, I have memory deficits. And that was completely wiped when the Neurontin was discontinued, and Dr. Race has noted that. So, this lady, if I may, Your Honor, this lady was an extremely intelligent lady. When she testified at the Industrial Accident Board, this is part of the decision-making process. When I asked her a question, she snapped back with an answer. She was very, very cognizant, very, very alert and oriented to what was happening and all the questions that were being asked. So her theory is that I have a problem with my thinking. I have a problem with my decision-making process here. And at the hearing, it was just exactly the opposite. Absolutely the opposite. I'm asking her, what do you do, what are your hobbies? I read Russian history. I read Renaissance history. I read American history. I like orchids. Orchids, that's a very esoteric area to be in, for some folks. And then she goes off to say, I do gardening. I like to do gardening. I don't do as much as I used to, but I still do some gardening. Well, that was completely contrary to what she said on direct examination. On direct examination, she said, if I move my left arm, it hurts. I'm in pain. It's almost debilitating pain. On bad days, all I reach for is the remote on my TV. But yet, on the cross-examination, when I ask her about her activities, she's talking about, gardening and maintaining orchids. She's talking about being doing some sculpting and so forth. So, going back to your original question, Your Honor, is this is all part of the analysis that she really doesn't have it. The statement that Dr. Colt made that she has a decision-making process just wasn't accepted. That particular conclusion just wasn't accepted. It was rejected. Dr. Grace's evaluation of that issue was accepted, and ergo, she was found not to be totally disabled. If I may also, I'd like to address the issues of what the claimant is raising today on this commutation issue. As Judge Babiard's, not Judge Babiard, but he may comment about errors that he saw, but ultimately on the merits of the case, Judge Babiard's found on the record of the case supported the ultimate decision of the Industrial Accident Board in the matter. The heart of the case was medical incapacity to work. The heart of the case was, it all came down to, was there a cognitive deficit? That was a statement that was rejected, and therefore the theory was rejected ultimately. But the issue of these errors, the commutation reference is made in the statement of determination. It's not made in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. In that particular section of the board's decision, the board clearly references correctly that Ms. Cohen consented to a termination in June of 2001. So,
well, if the word commutation had appeared four lines earlier in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, would that make a difference?
I never thought of that, Your Honor. I guess the question becomes, is that error so egregious that you have to question the analysis of the board? And maybe it would have impact. But in the ultimate analysis of the board, on the factual findings and the conclusions of law, they have that fact correct.
So that could have been a material error, but for the placement of the word in the opinion.
The placement of the error is everything.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mendel.
There was talk about the error of the word commutation. We discussed it earlier. I think you have to look at the entire decision of the board. If that was the only incorrect statement, the only misnomer in that decision, we might be able to give the board the benefit of the doubt and say, well, gee, maybe they made a little bit of a mistake. But when you go through the entire decision, we've identified, I believe, 11 errors of misstatements in the board in their findings of fact, and areas which are very significant. For example, it was talked about the medication. The board found that Dr. Culp believed that Ms. Cullen's medication could be adjusted. There was nothing in the testimony that said that. In fact, Dr. Racis said that the medication was reasonable, necessary, and related to the accident. The board quoted Dr. Racis as saying that the need for the narcotic medication was questionable. Yet he testified that it was reasonable, necessary, related, and there was no one at the hearing that gave any kind of indication that Ms. Cullen should be taking this medication. The board also made errors in terms of...
Counsel, I think you laid out in your brief the errors. I do have one question that was prompted by a statement by opposing counsel. Does the record show that your client was earning about $75 a week in 1995?
Correct. Her compensation rate at the time of the accident, at the time of the hearing, was $71.97 per week. What her compensation
was. And the board found, based on the expert testimony, that the average weekly wage of the positions that she was able to work at was $323.30.
I believe so, based upon the labor market survey, right. But that the employer had introduced at the hearing.
So even if you adjust those numbers for inflation, opposing counsel is correct that by the time of the hearing, she would be in a position to earn considerably more than she would have had she remained as a food service worker, right?
I mean, I think that's the idea is that she was earning so little at the time of the accident. She was working part-time in a part-time job.
Is that legally significant to your case?
No, not for the issue that we have outstanding. My client could not have made a claim for any additional money because of the compensation rate that she had. To make a claim for any loss of earning capacity, we would have to show that what she was earning at the time of the accident minus what she can earn now, she would be entitled to 2/3 of that as for temporary partial disability benefits. So on that basis, she would not be entitled to any additional.
Did your client make an alternative argument that even if she's found not to be totally disabled, she's entitled at the very least to a continuation of what she had previously agreed to have terminated?
Well, no. The only alternative we could have made would have been an argument to say that she was temporary partially disabled, and she would have that, again, that we had to go through that calculation as to the amount that she would receive. But given such a small amount of her average weekly wage of $75 per week, we could not make a claim for any loss of earning capacity, even at a part-time job with the rates are today that she would have been able to make.
You're saying there is no claim that she's permanently partially disabled?
No, not given her low average weekly wage and compensation rate. The only other part that I'd like to point out was that, again, this wasn't a case of the board accepting one doctor over the other and saying, gee, we believe Dr. Racis. It's not clear from the board's decision who they believe or what they believed or what facts they relied upon, given all of these misstatements in the record. So we really don't know exactly what the board was looking at. If you look at all those misstatements that I've pointed out, you look at somebody who can work with medication, it's questionable whether she should be taking this medication, can do all these things that the board said that she can do, then it makes it look like somebody who can work. But if you look at the correct facts of what's stated, it gives a different picture. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Please rise.